I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Earthquakes over the last 7 days remind us that the Earth's geology affects us all, even here in the Midwest. In fact, geological events have long-reaching effects on human history. For example, the French Revolution was brought on partly by a food shortage resulting from a volcanic explosion in Iceland. Earthquakes and tsunamis pose continuous threats in many parts of the U.S., and the possibility that one could wipe out an entire city in an instant with no warning makes them one of the most feared natural hazards. On this Earth Day, we'll discuss earthquakes, volcanoes, and how they've shaped human history, as well as talk about how scientists attempt to predict future events. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week's earthquake centered in Illinois is a reminder that the Earth's geology affects us all, even those of us here in the Midwest. In fact, geological events have long-reaching effects on human history. For example, the French Revolution was brought on partly by a food shortage resulting from a volcanic explosion in Iceland in 1783. And that potential for major disasters continues to this day. Today we'll talk Geology 101, earthquakes, volcanoes, and we'll take a radio journey to the center of the Earth, and we'll talk about how some of these events over the centuries have shaped our history. Our guest today is Michael Wisession, who is an earth science professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the author of several textbooks, and his research interests include seismic wave propagation, diffracted wave dispersion, and seismic arrays, simple concepts that my fourth grader already has mastered. And Dr. Wisession joins us this morning from Washington University in St. Louis. Michael, nice to have you. Good morning.
Welcome. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Simple concepts, to be sure, right?
Well, it spans the whole range. It can be explained simply.
We'll get there. The Midwest, of all places, just experienced this 5.2 earthquake that was centered in southern Illinois. Did you know it was coming?
Unfortunately, we are totally unable to predict earthquakes, so No one knew it was coming.
Why can't you predict them?
Well, it's interesting. There are some geophysical phenomena like volcanoes that we've actually been tremendously successful in predicting, and thousands of lives are saved every year from this. Because before you have a volcano that erupts, the magma has to crack its way to the surface, so there are millions of small little earthquakes as that magma moves to the surface. The caldera bulges out, the temperature changes, the gas composition changes, and in some cases we've actually been able to predict down to the day when a volcano erupts. Earthquake is an entirely different phenomenon. It's the last straw that breaks the camel's back. I mean, imagine you take the pencil on your desk and you begin to bend it, and it bends and bends. At what point does that pencil snap? Well, you would need to know exactly the interior properties of that pencil, the strength throughout the pencil, to determine the exact moment that the stress reaches some critical level. And, of course, we suffer, all geologists suffer, from the terrible handicap that light doesn't travel through rock. So we just can't see what's down under the ground. We don't know where the faults are. We don't know what the rock is made of, unless, of course, we go down and we drill it. But that affects the whole structure of the ground, and that would change all the conditions anyway.
Well, given all that, Michael, can you foresee a day when you will be able to forecast an earthquake, or are there just so many variables here that that's just unlikely for maybe centuries to come?
Well, you know, that's such an important question, and certainly seismologists and geophysicists have spent a lot of time and effort trying to figure out how to predict an earthquake. And I will say that there are some members of my community who are of the opinion that earthquakes will never be predicted, that they are a random chaotic event. However, I think a large part of my community also recognizes that there are precursory events that happen before some earthquakes, and that gives us some hope that we may eventually be able to predict them.
Well, in this particular earthquake that occurred last week, Michael, what happened?
Well, it's important to understand the context of how our planet works. You know, there are more than 200,000 earthquakes that are located every year. They happen all the time. In fact, there's a magnitude 6 earthquake somewhere around the world on average every 3 days.
Hmm.
Now, if they don't happen near a big city, you never hear about it. Most of these earthquakes happen along the boundaries between Earth's tectonic plates. So this is this underlying fundamental principle of plate tectonics that explains our surface geology, and that is that the surface is divided into about a dozen large sheets of rock that are mostly rigid, and as these sheets bang into each other or slide past each other, you get lots of earthquakes. The San Andreas is a good example. It's the best example here in North America. And what's happening is you have the Pacific plate moving northward relative to the North American plate. Los Angeles is actually not in North America. It's actually on the Pacific plate.
Hmm.
And in 13 million years, Los Angeles will be a suburb of San Francisco or vice versa, I guess, depending on where you're from. But here in the Midwest, we don't have a plate boundary, but that doesn't mean that we don't get earthquakes. And in fact, if you go throughout the world, earthquakes, even large earthquakes, have happened everywhere at one time or another.
Well, in our neck of the woods, though, we have this new Madrid fault you hear about in southeast Missouri that I've always been told potentially could be a real monster, right?
Well, it's interesting. Let me explain a little bit about what's going on here. Have you ever watched an old Errol Flynn movie with some ship going over the ocean waves, and as the ship rises up and down over the swell of the ocean, you hear the boards creaking and groaning as the ship bends?
Sure.
Well, that's exactly what North America is doing. We're moving westward away from Europe. Now, not as fast as the ship. We're going at about an inch a year. It's actually less than the rate that your hair grows. I mean, it's not going to change airfares to London during our lifetimes. But over geologic time, it opens up the Atlantic Ocean. In fact, if you'd been hanging around 200 million years ago, you could have walked from New York City to West Africa. Now, this motion of North America as it moves westward is moving over a lumpy mantle. The rock there has hot and cold regions, and it causes our plate, our continent, to bend and flex just like the boards of that ocean ship. However, when the continent bends and flexes, those are earthquakes.
Hmm.
And so you get this cracking and faulting and rifting throughout the rigid interiors of plates and not just at the plate boundaries. Now, something interesting goes on here at New Madrid, and in this case, the Wabash Valley seismic zone that extends up along the Wabash River valley that separates Indiana and Illinois.
Hmm.
This is a region of weakness in the crust. Now, it's important to understand, for most of us, we like to think of the ground as being stable beneath our feet, right? Our lives are so busy and hectic. It's nice to have something in our lives that's constant and unchanging. And the bad news that I have for the listeners here is nothing could be further from the truth.
That's one of the points you're making from your research, is that this Earth is constantly moving, shifting, and changing, and just to the contrary of what we all tend to think, right?
Absolutely. It just does it on a longer time scale than we see. So its motions are in the order of centimeters to inches a year. But it is no less active. If you could view the Earth sped up on the Earth's lifetime, you would see this churning, roiling, boiling, mantle of rock with huge sheets of ocean seafloor sinking all the way down to the core, heating up and rising up as large plumes of hot rock. Only that cycle takes about half a billion years to occur, so it's a fairly long process. Now, interestingly, the New Madrid area and the Wabash Valley seismic zone were very tectonically active about 750 million years ago. And in fact, the continent almost rifted apart here at that time. Talk about a civil war tearing the country apart. We almost broke into two pieces of continent, and there would have been an ocean in between Illinois and Indiana.
Huh.
However, that process ran out of steam. We see this happening. Sometimes rifts continue and you get a new ocean. That's what's happening with the Red Sea. The whole Arabian Peninsula used to be part of Africa, and now it has broken away and a new ocean is opening up in between. The rift system here that runs all the way up the Mississippi River and the Wabash River, that almost became an ocean back at that time, but the rifting stopped. Now, we continue to see the effects of that rifting, though, because what happened at the time was the crust was stretched. Imagine taking a piece of silly putty or taffy and begin to pull it apart. The whole continent thinned and actually lower down. In fact, that's why the rivers run down these valleys. The rivers find the lowest places of of elevation, and they find that fault zone, and they flow down it. However, rock is different from taffy and silly putty. It's more rigid. Mm-hmm. And so as well as stretching and thinning, there was also a tremendous amount of faulting and cracking. And the continent retains those faults within the crust, you know, for ages. I like to think of North America as sort of like a fairly successful car in a demolition derby. You know, it retains all the dents and scars and scrapes from all the collisions with other continents. And indeed, we've been banging around against other continents over the last 4 billion years.
Well, that's a great analogy.
But we're still moving. You know, we're still going. However, there are these zones of weakness within the crust. And then when you bend or stretch the continent, it tends to crack along places that have this inherent weakness remnant still within it.
So given all that, how potentially dangerous is this new Madrid fault that we hear so much about?
Well, I have some good news to people who live in Missouri, and that is the risk from the New Madrid Fault area, it turns out to be much less than people thought it was a few decades ago. The U.S. Geological Survey had a team of people who reassessed the magnitudes of those earthquakes. They looked at reports of shaking from across the whole Midwestern and Eastern regions and determined that the three large earthquakes that happened in 1811 and 1812 were magnitudes 7.0, 7.2, and 7.4. They were nowhere near the magnitude 8 that some people had at one time thought the earthquake might be. Now, the difference between a 7 and 8 may not sound like a lot to you, but the way the magnitude scale works, every time you go up one unit from a 6 to a 7 or a 7 to an 8, the energy released increases by more than 30 times. So there's a huge difference between a magnitude 8 and a magnitude 7. Magnitude 7s are fairly common. There are 15, 20 of them every year around the world. And it makes sense to us that these earthquakes were low magnitude 7s because, for instance, St. Louis was around at the time and some loose chimneys fell down in East St. Louis. And were that earthquake to happen again, some loose chimneys in St. Louis will fall down. There were places much closer to New Madrid, like St. Genevieve, that had no damage at all, that were entirely unscathed from it.
So your point is we don't have to worry so much about the New Madrid, you're saying.
Well, and that the first part of it is the first part of it is the earthquakes were smaller than they are sometimes made out to be. The second thing, and the nice thing, is the seismic activity really seems to have tailed off almost to nothing. There hasn't even been a magnitude 6 earthquake or above in this region in more than a century, and there hasn't even been a magnitude 5 or larger in the New Madrid area in more than 35 years.
And that suggests that things have settled in a fairly equitable way then, it sounds like. There.
Well, what happens for intraplate earthquakes, these are earthquakes in the middle of a plate as opposed to along the San Andreas or some other plate boundary, is as far as we can tell, they seem to go in spurts. And the way I think of it, you know, go back to your ocean ship sailing over the water, or imagine taking a sheet of plywood and bending it. It would that piece of plywood as you bent it would begin to splinter and crack. But it'd go in little spurts in different places. You'd get a crack in one place and then a crack in another. And the whole board would eventually break, but the cracking would move all about over time. Well, it seems the same thing happens with earthquakes in the middle of continents. You get a spurt of activity in one area, and then that seismic activity tails off, and then it goes to some other area. Now, it may be reactivated again in the future. But we have scientists have put out arrays of GPS instruments all around the New Madrid area, and they see no sign of motion. In other words, if you want to break something, you've got to bend it first. Well, there's no bending going on there. There's no sign that that earthquake will happen. And given with the fact that the level of seismic activity is tailed off, really it could be thousands of years before another earthquake of the magnitude 7 or above happens in the New Madrid area. It may be that the Wabash Valley seismic zone is now due for an increase in seismic activity.
This is the one farther over in Indiana, right?
That's right, the one that happened this past weekend. The magnitude 5.2 and then the set of aftershocks that followed. That had another magnitude 5-6 years ago near Evansville, Indiana. And we know from a field called paleoseismology, this is by looking at the sedimentary layers for evidence of previous earthquakes, that this area has had several large earthquakes in the past, going back over the past 20,000 years, maybe even as large as a magnitude 7. So it may be that New Madrid's going to tail off for a while, and then this area, you know, in southern Illinois will then ramp up and have seismic activity. I have to say, you know, living in St. Louis, I'm really not worried about an earthquake along the New Madrid Fault. I'm more worried about an earthquake happening along faults that are closer to where I live, because the whole continent is filled with these faults, and because we can't see through rock, we can't see them. We don't know they're there. A very interesting example of this has happened in California, which has had several large magnitude 7 or so earthquakes happen over the last couple decades. Almost none of them have been on the San Andreas Fault. The ones that were hitting Los Angeles, like the Northridge earthquake in 1994, right, or the Landers earthquake, those were on faults we didn't even know existed.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that in just a moment here. Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and our guest today is Michael Wysession, who's an earth science professor at Washington University over in St. Louis. We're sort of talking a geology 101 primer here, covering earthquakes, volcanoes, and everything else. Do you worry that an earthquake, maybe the big one, will hit the Midwest someday? That's our question on the table. You can take part in our conversation on our website at go to kcur.org/up-to-date. And look for Join the Discussion, or give us a call here, 816-235-2888. Again, that's area code 816-235-2888. Michael, how do the faults in the Midwest compare to the San Andreas Fault that gets all the attention all the time?
Well, I think, you know, people tend to think black and white. Either a region has a seismic risk or it doesn't. Either something's good or it's bad. And, of course, the reality is always somewhere in between. Certainly not being on a plate boundary, the risks of earthquakes throughout the entire interior of the country are much lower.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
However, they are certainly always present. There was a magnitude 6 outside of Chicago in 1909. There was a huge magnitude 7 plus earthquake in Charleston in 1886. If you go to cities like Philadelphia or Boston or New York or Washington, they've all had significant earthquakes occur near them within the last several hundred years. Now, none of these compare to the seismic risks that occur out west. And actually, the San Andreas is not the danger. It's the large fault beneath Portland and Seattle that's going to be the mega earthquake that's going to significantly affect our country.
No, I didn't know that. Why doesn't that get more attention?
Well, it's a fairly recent discovery, and of course, you know, the Sumatra earthquake that happened in 2004 really woke a lot of people up to the dangers of earthquakes. This was a magnitude 9.3 earthquake, and this was an enormous earthquake, the largest to have happened in decades. It turns out the San Andreas in California can never be anywhere near as large as that. In fact, if the entire San Andreas ruptured all at once, top to bottom, all along the 1,300 plus kilometers of the San Andreas Fault, you'd get about an 8.3.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an 8.3 is a large earthquake, but that's 30 times smaller than a Sumatra earthquake. You would need 30 of those to equal one of those Sumatra earthquakes. However, the same type of geology that caused the Sumatra earthquake also exists in Seattle and Portland, and that is part of the Pacific Northwest. It involves a sheet of the ocean seafloor sinking beneath the continent. Now, we know that happens because we can see it with seismic imaging, and that's what causes all the volcanoes. The volcanoes from Mount Lassen all the way up through Mount St. Helens mm-hmm. and Shasta and Hood and Rainier all occur because as the piece of the Pacific Ocean seafloor sinks underground, it brings water with it. The water goes into the rock of the mantle. It causes the rock to melt, and it comes up as lava out of the volcanoes. But that sheet of Pacific Ocean seafloor sometimes plunges down, tens of meters in a matter of minutes. That's what happened with Sumatra. And we know that that happened on January 26, 1700, beneath Seattle and Portland. The way we know it is actually a fascinating story. When European settlers moved there, the Native Americans there had all sorts of stories of a tremendous time of violence, of the gods shaking and landslides and all, you know. And the settlers thought it was the volcanoes which were erupting. Well, it turns out a set of Japanese scientists looked at the history of tsunamis in the Pacific Ocean by looking at tidal gauge records in different Japanese ports. Because the Japanese have kept accurate tidal gauge records, accurate to the minute, going back centuries. And they were able to find several of these events. And the largest one occurred January 26th, 1700. And by looking at when the waves hit the different ports in Japan, they got a direction and it points right back to Seattle.
We'll leave it to the Japanese to keep good records, right?
So, and by looking back into paleoseismic history, we see that these large events have happened. Again, magnitude 9. I mean, something that we have no concept of here in the 48 states. That these large earthquakes happen maybe every 400 or 500 years. The one before had happened 400 years previously, around 1300. Well, it's now been more than 300 years. And so we're getting into the time when that next earthquake happens. And when it does, Seattle and Portland will be absolutely devastated.
Well, do you worry that an earthquake, maybe the big one, will hit the Midwest someday? Again, our number here, 816-235-2888, or take part in our conversation online at kcur.org/uptodate. Let's go to some phone calls here. And Chris from Overland Park. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Fantastic conversation. I wanted to talk about geological activity, the big 9 earthquakes. I know that at the breakup of the major ice sheets at the last ice age caused unbelievable geological upheavals. And, you know, several geological features in Sweden and the Parvi among them are formed by these things. I know that our ice caps today are much smaller, but given the rapid rate of breakup, what kind of isostatic or eustatic effects can we expect to see from this kind of rapid breakup of the ice caps on top of the spinning Earth? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Chris, that's a great question. Michael, go ahead.
Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, I've talked mostly about horizontal motions, you know, plates moving laterally. But you bring up an excellent point here, and that is not so long ago, 15, 20,000 years ago, you know, Chicago was under more than a kilometer of ice. And it's sort of like sitting down on a waterbed, or I guess maybe a molasses bed, you know, something that's a little more viscous. And so when that ice sheet appeared on the northern part of North America, it pushed the whole continent down. The rock way underneath, hundreds of kilometers down, moved out of the way, and the whole continent moved down. The ice was melted fairly rapidly, which happens at the end of each set of ice ages. When you go into this interglacial period, the temperature warms quickly, and Canada is on the rise. I mean, I don't mean politically or socially. I don't know. Maybe it is. But geologically, Canada is rising up at about a millimeter a year, and that's actually caused some large earthquakes. There was a very large earthquake off the coast of Labrador in 1929. In fact, it caused a landslide that caused the last large tsunami to hit. Many tens of people died from the tsunami that hit the coast of Labrador from that earthquake. There was an earthquake about a decade ago off the coast of Antarctica. It was a magnitude 8.2 earthquake, a huge earthquake in an area that had never had an earthquake before. And we think it's exactly this point, that as the ice is melting, it's essentially like sitting up off of that waterbed, and the continent begins to rise up. And as it does, it causes the whole continent, the whole plate, to bend and flex. And sometimes, you know, as far as the Earth goes, these are little creaks and groans. To us, they can be huge, devastating earthquakes.
Let's go to Pete from Kansas City, Missouri. Pete, you're on with Dr. Michael Y. Session.
Thank you. I understand we have what I was taught karst topography in the Kansas City and Missouri area and stretching into Kansas over toward Manhattan. Are we at risk here due to the structure of our geology?
Yeah, thank you, Pete. Michael?
The question is a very good one about the karst topography. Interestingly,
what is that, Doctor?
Karst topography is what happens when you have layers of carbonate rocks like limestone, calcium carbonate, that are underground, and the groundwater dissolves away the rock, leaving huge networks of caves. You know, Missouri is known as the cave state. We've got more than 5,000 mapped caves here. And these networks of caves spread throughout the whole Midwest because the limestone exists for literally hundreds and thousands of kilometers around. And it gets filled with holes, and the surface often collapses to form sinkholes and other features as the ground dissolves away underneath.
Mm-hmm.
The risk for the earthquakes is actually from much deeper. So, for instance, the earthquake that happened on Friday in southern Illinois was about 12 kilometers down, below the sedimentary layers in most cases, and down actually in the granite type rocks of the crust. Now, water does play an interesting role sometimes. There have been cases where pumping water into the ground has actually triggered earthquakes. This happened in Colorado, where once they were pumping radioactive wastewater down underground, and the water lubricated faults there, and earthquakes began to occur. But these are small earthquakes, and the dangers come from larger earthquakes that are actually much deeper and below the karst materials.
Let's do this. Let's take a break, Michael. When we come back, we'll talk about one of Michael's notions that you can trace the entire course of human civilization through one volcano here or there. We'll also take a radio journey to the center of the Earth. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today we're visiting with Dr. Michael Wisession, who's an earth science professor at Washington University in St. Louis. We're talking about last week's earthquake centered in southern Illinois. We're talking about volcanoes and the impact they have really on world history. Your comments and questions always welcome here, 816-235-2888, or take part in our conversation online at kcur.org/up to date and look for join the discussion. Let's go back to some phone calls here. And Constance from Atchison, good morning.
Good morning. I'm laughing because last Friday morning my husband had gotten out of bed and he couldn't sleep. He went in the other room. He fell back asleep watching TV. And my bed started shaking. And I lay there thinking, oh, I'm crazy. And I finally got up and I went in and I said, the bed's shaking. And he didn't believe me. And I wasn't vindicated until Sunday when someone told us there had been an earthquake.
Ah, there you go.
But my colleagues yesterday in Atchison, they didn't believe my story. They still hadn't heard about it. They still don't believe me that I felt an earthquake. So I feel really good that this actually did happen and I didn't dream it.
Well,
and I'm not scared of earthquakes. Thank you for your show.
Thank you, Constance. Let's go to Eldera from Lenexa. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Well, I was in the 1963 Alaskan earthquake, the Good Friday earthquake.
Mm.
And we Alaskans, of course, have a tendency to exaggerate everything. And we have always thought that that was the largest earthquake. And I think it was 8.9 or something like that. I can't quite remember the figures. And I just wonder, does our guest think that we're right that that was the largest earthquake in North America?
Hmm.
Well, that yes, it was a Good Friday. It was actually 1964.
You're right. Sorry.
He knows his stuff, Eldera.
And that earthquake actually was we have reassessed that, and that was a magnitude 9.4.
Yes, I read that.
And the only earthquake that we know of that was larger than that was a magnitude 9.5 that happened in Chile in 1960. Those are the two largest earthquakes. But yes, indeed. Now, fortunately, for Alaskans, that earthquake actually began its rupture near the coast and then ruptured out towards the ocean. So most of the energy was sent out to sea, and the loss of life and damage, though it was tremendous, especially in Anchorage and the surrounding areas, was much less than it could have been if the earthquake had ruptured in the opposite direction.
Eldara, how did you get through it? What do you recall from that day?
Well, you know, when I heard of this earthquake here in Illinois last week, I thought I'd forgotten all about the Anchorage one, and I immediately went back to nightmares and everything else. It stays with you a long time. Someone has said that the Earth is the last thing we can that's one thing we can depend on for being secure. That you know, the ground doesn't leave you wrong. It left us.
That's right.
I was in a house in a committee meeting actually, and it started shaking and we all laughed and aha, another quake, you know. And then it shook so badly that I grabbed onto the doorknob and was thrown outside and spent the next 3 minutes dodging cars that were going around like toys. It was an amazing experience.
Wow.
And then some.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, Eldara, thank you for the good phone call and a difficult reminiscence. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye now. Well, Michael, one thing people may not know is the extent to which world history has been altered by these major geological events. In fact, you have said you can trace the entire course of human civilization through one volcano here, a change in the Gulf Stream there. Tell us about that.
Well, certainly. You know, I'm fascinated by earthquakes. In fact, I'm going to be lecturing this Thursday at 5:30 at the Linda Hall Library, and I'll be talking largely about earthquakes at that time. That lecture is open to the public. But I have to say that there are a whole suite of geologic events that have really shaped our entire history as a race and as in terms of civilizations. Now, I'm not naive enough to say that you need to throw away all the history books and that it's all due to geology. But it's quite striking if you go back. You gave the example of the French Revolution. There was a very wise American statesman living in Paris in the late 1800s who noticed that the sunlight was shining at about half its strength and documented how it was so cold during the summer.
I bet that guy was Benjamin Franklin, right?
He was indeed. And he guessed correctly that the eruptions of Hekla volcano in Iceland and also Asama volcano in Japan was erupting at the same time, threw so much particulate matter and aerosols into the atmosphere that it lowered global temperatures considerably for several years. In fact, the winter before the storming of the Bastille in France in 1789 was the coldest winter of the century. And, you know, the whole thing about let them eat cake was because they didn't have any bread. People were starving to death by the millions all across Europe. And in fact, France is only one of about a dozen governments that collapsed during about that time. You know, if people are starving to death, then governments, you know, become unstable. And, you know, you can look at the settling of the United States, the big push in 1816, people heading out west, you know, was also due to a large volcano that happened in Indonesia, Mount Tambora, in 1815. You know, what would make people throw their life's belongings in some covered wagon and head off, you know, leave their family and friends and their lives into some unknown territory? Well, they'll do that if they're starving, and that's what happened. That year was known as the year without a summer. It snowed in New England during the summer.
Wow.
And, in fact, the Farmer's Almanac became an instant hit. No one had heard of it before then, but it had a typo that predicted snow in June, and it snowed in June.
You're
and they became
kidding.
An instant hit. But the large push westward because people in the East Coast were simply starving because the temperatures got so cold that the crops failed.
And on this continent, you had the wiping out of some Native American tribes around 1700, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you can go back, you know, for as large as earthquakes are in the effect, the bigger effects happen through climate change. And one very dramatic effect is when global temperatures warm, the Southwest and Central America become very, very dry. So you look at all these cliff dwellings, Mesa Verde, Bandelier, Chaco Canyon, they were all abandoned. And the reason they were abandoned was they just dried up. There were periods of decades at one point in the late 1100s where it just stopped raining, and the Native Americans abandoned them and moved elsewhere. It was about the same time that the Mayan civilization collapsed. Mm. And again, they used their resources poorly. There are other factors involved. But if you don't have any water, it's just very hard to live, hard to survive. You know, one of the biggest events happened at the end of the warm period, the medieval warm period, or the beginning of 1300. In fact, there are many parts of Europe where populations have still not returned to the levels they were in the year 1300. The temperature got very cold, crops failed, and by the time you got through the great famines of 1315, 1317, about a third of Europe had died of starvation. Mm. And interestingly, the rains that came that fell all across Eurasia led to the plague. There was such extreme flooding that one year in 1332, more than 7 million Chinese died along the Yellow River. Mm. And all of these deaths led to a rise in the rat population, and the rats carried the fleas, and the fleas carried the plague. And the starving Europeans were buying grain from wherever they could. The grain ships came from China, and every port that those ships came, the plague spread out of. By the end of that century, about 70% of people in England had died, for instance. And if you go back in history, there are many such events where tens of percents of the populations locally have died. Hmm. We have no conception now of what it would mean to have billions of people die. But this happened quite regularly up until the last couple centuries.
That's the voice of Dr. Michael Y. Session, and he'll be speaking as he just pointed out, he'll be speaking at 5:30 on Thursday at the Linda Hall Library. That's at 5109 Cherry Street in Kansas City. It's free and open to the public. Our number here for your questions and comments about earthquakes and any fears you have about them or volcanoes, 816-235-2888, or join our conversation online at kcur.org/up-to-date and look for Join the Discussion. Let's go to Kristen from Kansas City, Missouri. Kristen, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
Good. I just was calling because I'm from San Francisco originally and been through many, many earthquakes.
Congratulations.
The quake of 89.
Yeah.
Lived to tell the tale. Actually, I got buried under my desk at work and had to be dug out. But it wasn't bad in the Bay Area where we were. But I wanted to ask the doctor about a program I had watched on one of the nature programs. And they talked about the trend for earthquakes in Turkey and that area and how, based on a pathway of earthquakes that had taken place over many, many years, they anticipate, or literally they're calling it a prediction of an earthquake in Istanbul, a major earthquake that will take place. And I wanted to know what the doctor had to say about that.
Yeah, thank you, Kristen.
Thanks.
Yes, this is a fascinating work pioneered by a friend of mine, Ross Stein, in California. And what Ross noticed was that if you look at the history of earthquakes along, it's called the Anatolian Fault, mm-hmm. Which is a strike slip fault very similar to the San Andreas Fault. And if you look at the earthquakes along there, they seem to follow a progression in time westward. And essentially, that sort of makes sense. Imagine if you're tearing a sheet of paper. If you tear it in one place, you increase the stress adjacent to that tear, and you're more liable to tear the piece of paper in the next spot. And we've seen that in many cases where earthquakes may propagate over time. Now, what has people scared is after that 1999 earthquake in Izmit, the next place west is right near Istanbul.
Right. Hmm.
And, of course, Istanbul is, you know, has 20 million people or so there. However, now the good news is if you look at some of the structures there, the minarets of the Hagia Sophia and other places, they've stood for thousands of years. And so, I think the odds are that the earthquake that will happen there, though it will cause some damage, you know, won't destroy the city. But again, it's not a question of if this earthquake will occur. It's a question of when. Again, unfortunately, we just can't predict it. We can say, yeah, there's an increased probability of this earthquake happening here. But we can't point to the day. We can't give people warning. And so it'll happen. And when it does, it will cause a lot of chaos in that part of the world.
Thank you.
Kristen, thank you.
Sure.
You know, Michael, you've made it very clear that you can't predict these things, but what's the one tool at your disposal that scientists use to at least crack open a door to give them a sense of what might be happening out there?
Well, that's a very good question. If you look at certain earthquakes, they do have some precursory phenomena that I mentioned earlier. One example is you may see a radon gas coming out of the ground, or helium, essentially gases that are trapped underground. But as the ground is cracking before the earthquake happens, these gases are released. In other cases, you see changes in water well levels or water pressure. In other places, you may see a change in the magnetic field or the electrical resistivity. Essentially, the pore spaces in the rocks are connected, and electric current can travel through them more easily. However, we may need to see this happen a couple times for large earthquakes to recognize the characteristic for a particular fault. But because the large earthquakes only happen every few hundred years, it may take 1,000 years before we can recognize the characteristic for each fault. And, you know, it's hard to go to the government and say, would you please fund this area of research? I'll give you an answer in 1,000 years.
Yeah.
but unfortunately, that may be the reality. Now, it's interesting. A lot of people, every time I tell someone I'm a seismologist, they say, my Aunt Bertha in San Francisco's parakeet flew out the window before the earthquake. You know, I've heard this enough times that I think that there's something there. Now, we don't know what it is. It is true that animals have better senses than we do, or some of them do, and it's quite possible that they are feeling some low frequency oscillation that we don't feel, or they are hearing a sound. Earthquakes do cause audible sounds. Some of them are outside of our range of hearing. Perhaps they are sensing gases that we can't sense.
Right.
You know, I don't know what it is, but I hear it often enough that I wouldn't be surprised if there is something there.
Let's go to Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, you're on with Dr. Michael Wisession.
Yes, I just wanted to ask the doctor about the Easter Sunday earthquake in Lisbon and the effect it had on the Enlightenment and Voltaire and all of that.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, that's such a tragic story. You know, we don't hear much about Lisbon these days, but at that time in 1755 when that earthquake occurred, Lisbon was a jewel of Europe. It was a cultural center. Every bit Paris is equal. And an earthquake happened along the boundary between the Europe and European and African plates, and this created enormous shaking that knocked down much of the buildings of Lisbon and actually created fires that burned through the city for 5 days and created an enormous tsunami. Now, those you mentioned Voltaire, of course. You know, in Candide, one of the many evils that befalls Candide after he's gotten all this gold from El Dorado, he's got it in a ship in the port in Lisbon, and the tsunami comes and it sinks his ship and he loses all his gold. And the Spanish Inquisition, which wonders why this earthquake happened on All Saints Day, figures it must be because of the sins of the people, and they burn people at the stake and they crucify them, and they do that to Candide too, you know. And so Lisbon was essentially obliterated, and a huge cultural center of Europe disappeared in a day.
Hmm. Boy, that's amazing. Joe, thank you for the call. You know, Michael, when you are in town on Thursday evening, your lecture is titled Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and a Modern Journey to the Center of the Earth. Give us a preview of that journey to the center of the earth.
Well, you know, As I mentioned before, we can't see through rock. Mm-hmm. And so it's really unfortunate for geologists. You know, Edwin Hubble in 1929 could see the structure of galaxies billions of light years away because he could look at them through a telescope. And in the 1600s, Anton van Leeuwenhoek was looking at the structure of cells, again, using light from a microscope. I can't tell you what's 2 feet beneath the ground out here because I can't see through rock. We do have one method, however, and that's using seismic waves from earthquakes. So instead of earthquakes being just, you know, a bane, a hazard, we've been able to take advantage of these 200,000 earthquakes that we locate every year mm-hmm. and record them at thousands of seismometers that are located all around the planet. And we are able to use a form of tomography. It's much like medical tomography to make three-dimensional pictures of what the inside of our planet is.
What is at the core of the core of the Earth, Michael? What's there?
Well, what we find is just a remarkable, fascinating structure. The inner part of our Earth is iron. It's mostly liquid molten iron that's about 5,000 degrees Celsius, so that's almost 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And actually at the very center is a frozen snowball of iron. Now, I say frozen, of course. It's 6,000 degrees or so. I mean, it's the same temperature as the surface of the sun. But the pressure is so intense that it squeezes it into a solid form. And it's quite possible that there are little bits of iron rain falling out through the liquid core, outer core, and building up this snowball of ice that's slowly of metal, iron ice that's slowly growing over time.
Let's go back to some – go grab a phone call here. We have a whole full board of them here, Michael. Patty from Lee's Summit, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, we lived in California for about 12 years, and the last earthquake we were in was the Northridge earthquake, which was big enough to, shake us out of bed. But the question that I had or the thought that I had was, in California, you build buildings, you build homes with earthquakes in mind. So your homes are bolted to the foundation. You know, you have a lot of precautions for things like that. Should we be thinking about in this area with, the possibility of earthquakes of changing maybe building codes for that, or are there already building codes for that type of building with earthquakes in mind?
Well, it's interesting. I sat on in a meeting once about 10, 15 years ago with some members of the St. Louis City and leaders of some churches, and they wanted to know what can St. Louis do about an earthquake. Well, I told them you get about 25 seconds of advance warning from when the New Madrid earthquake occurs and those waves hit St. Louis. So what can you do with 25 seconds? Well, you could send the city into a panic.
Yeah.
You could, if you had high-speed trains like they have in Japan, you could shut them off. If you had modern gas line systems, you could shut those off. But we don't have any of that. And so you would have to build in that whole new infrastructure. Now, in a city that's already strapped for cash and struggling to pay for schools and education, for me to suggest that we take our money and do that would be irresponsible given the low seismic risk.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the key. Yes, we certainly could build structures in the Midwest to higher earthquake standards the way they do in California. But it's, will those buildings even be around in 1,000 or 2,000 years when that next earthquake occurs? And it's a tough call to make. And, I think you just have to draw the line a little bit lower down than you do in California, given the much lower seismic risk.
Right. Great.
Patty, thank you. Yeah, bye-bye. Email here from David from Deepwater, Missouri, Michael, and he writes, could you speak to the possibility of devastation when Yellowstone blows?
That's a very interesting question. Yes, Yellowstone. So many of you may have seen some of the PBS shows, the super volcano. And this is real. If you look at the largest volcanic eruptions to have happened in the last in the recent past, several of them – in recent past, I mean the last couple of million years. I'm speaking like a geologist here. Several of them have been in Yellowstone. Yellowstone erupted about 2.1 million years ago, 1.35 million years ago, and about 630,000 years ago.
Hmm.
Well, if you take those three points and you draw a line through them, the next point is right about now.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Now, if you look at what's going on at Yellowstone, using the same sort of GPS networks, sensors that we, for instance, measure the New Madrid activity with, we can see that Yellowstone is lifting up. It is bulging up. There is magma flowing up in beneath the caldera. The temperature is increasing there, so we know that magma is rising, coming closer to the surface. What we don't know is if we are building up to one of these catastrophic eruptions or if it's just part of a cycle where it'll ramp up for a little bit and then it'll go down. Some of these eruptions have involved thousands of cubic kilometers of ash and dust erupted. Now, to give you a sense, Mount St. Helens erupted about 1 cubic kilometer.
Mm-hmm.
So these are thousands of times larger.
Wow.
And when this has happened, it has covered this country with ash. Blanketed it. So our crops would fail.
Mm-hmm.
The global climates would plummet. It wouldn't just be our crops. The whole economy of the world would be severely stressed. And, you know, our economy is sort of on the edge as it is right now,
mm-hmm.
right? Put some sort of catastrophe like this on top of it. And again, you know, the potential for hundreds of millions to billions of people dying is not out of the question.
Michael, is it possible to relieve that pressure in Yellowstone? Is there anything we can do to mitigate it?
Not yet. And I doubt that we will get there. The amount of energy we're talking about so dwarfs, you know, anything that we do. We're like little ants crawling on the ground compared to the scale, the immense scale of energy released by these enormous volcanic eruptions and sometimes these enormous earthquakes as well.
Well, Michael, you've been a great guest. And thanks so much for taking some time with us today. And it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to have the opportunity to talk.
I'm sorry we couldn't get to all our phone calls today, but you can continue our chat online with other listeners in our online discussion board at kcur.org/up-to-date. And Michael Wysession is an associate professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He speaks this Thursday evening at 5:30 at the Linda Hall Library on the UMKC campus. You can find details about that event as well as continue the conversation online, find a biography of our guests, this week's schedule, previous broadcasts, and a link to sign up for our free podcast. It's all at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow we'll look at nature deficit disorder and efforts to get kids more connected with the outdoors. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble, Kara Codwell, Maria Carter, and Danny Alexander. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.